This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Chi. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Well, Jen's got her hands knee deep in fertilizer, something like that, I'm sure.
I know. I've dragged myself in from my forest garden for this. So this had better be a good show, darn it. It's got to be a better CB than planting fruit trees.
Right, it's up there on Walton's call. Mountain.
You're like yeah. I washed my hands for this.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, no, Doug knows now how deep the obsession goes. I sent him a list of all the things I've planted so far. It's a few things.
Oh, share. What is it season for?
Oh, I don't care what season it's for. Yeah.
Don't even get her started.
If people are really interested, I'm so obsessed that I'm actually doing a whole additional podcast on gardening and permaculture and survival gardening and, you know, growing food and foraging during the apocalypse. If people are interested in such things, for my Patreon, it's called Hoeing Ain't Easy. So come on my beautiful Patreon and you can participate in our garden chats.
That is beautiful. That is great.
Well, speaking of memberships, I wanted to just remind the listeners to join up the Living Wisdom Library. There's just a lot of Q&As. I know the last few weeks as I've been transitioning from Fasting Escape, I had a little delays with some of the shows. And I know you guys had a Q&A last week on Wednesday, which was, I heard was really good. And then a Q&A a couple weeks before that too. So if you are a member of the Living Wisdom Library on esteemdynamics.com, then you'll get to hear all kinds of fresh new content with Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk.
Oh yeah.
We do. We do a member only Q&A every other week.
Yeah.
More or less, unless our schedules are so at odds with each other that we can't, you know, do it right on time, but we try to make up for it as soon as we can. So,
yeah.
And that's in addition to all the other stuff that's on there just for members. So, yeah.
Yep. And they're video, so you get to see Jen's dogs.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Unless I have a background up, which I did this week. I had my Soylent Green background, so no dog cameos, but you can still hear them.
Yeah.
So yeah.
All good.
Yep. Wonderful.
All right, Nathan, what do we got going?
All right. Well, we've got some questions today. We're just gonna get right down to it. So, dear doctors, I'm worried about my daughter. She graduated with the perfect GPA from Princeton University with bachelor's and master's while also modeling part-time. After finishing her graduate degree, she moved to New York to pursue modeling. It was going well, she was making good money, but then she developed an eating disorder and quit because of this. Then, attempting to follow in her father's footsteps of becoming a doctor, she attended a highly ranked medical school but dropped out during her second year due to an illness caused by stress. She moved back home, took a few years to recover, but now she's at 31 years old. She doesn't want to work or go back to school. In fact, she barely leaves the house. Whenever I try to talk to her about it, she starts crying and we never get anywhere. She doesn't want to date either. My husband and I plan on retiring to Europe in the next year or two, and she said she wants to come with us and live with us into our old age. I'm very kind and agreeable, so I'd never push her out of the house, but I hate to see her waste her life like this. Please help. I don't know what to do to help her.
I have a few thoughts. Jen, you go ahead with first pass with anything you're thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty straightforward case of somebody who's ego trapped in every direction. Mm-hmm. This sounds like a very high flying, high achieving, highly capable, very talented young lady who, you know, kind of coasted through life, did very well due to her innate talents and abilities, and got a lot of positive feedback for most of her existence, and ran into some competitive turmoil, you know, found some situations when she started to kind of meet the limit of where what she could easily achieve, relatively speaking, and started to feel some competitive pressure, which everybody is going to run into at some point in their upward trajectory. And she got really cornered by it and has sort of retreated and feels overwhelmed and can't break down those competitive dilemmas into small enough parts to feel like they are solvable. And so has opted out of life and, you know, is a very reasonable course of action given the inferences that she's making, with the experiences that she's had. So, the way out of that is to, you know, for her to, she would have to come to this on her own. You can't do this for her. She would have to have a desire to, sort of live in an unlived life. And some of these things that you're describing may not have been true dreams that she had. There were things that she felt sort of were expected of her or socially pressured into, or that she just got tracked into and discovered that it wasn't actually a great passionate thing for her to be doing. And that can contribute to some of the ego trap too. So I think there's a couple of different forces at work here, but this is somebody who possibly ran into a combination of factors, including I'm not doing what I really want to be doing with my life. And I don't think, you know, people seem to think I'm going to be a lot more successful at these endeavors than I believe that I can be. And so the correct thing for me to do to preserve my status in the village is to retreat. And so if there was, you know, if there are pieces here of things that she still genuinely desires to achieve in life, you know, if she did want to finish med school, for example, you know, go back after this illness and finish it up, if that's something that is a really genuinely held passion of hers and not just a family or social expectation, then, you know, she could be kind of walked through the steps to make that goal into tiny little steps that start to feel doable and tractable. But that's only going to work if that's really what she wants to be doing with her life. And we don't know that from this question. So that's my general take on it. It sounds like a very reasonable pivot from somebody who is cornered by esteem forces that we talk a lot about.
Well, this is what it must have felt like being Dean Smith coaching Michael Jordan.
I think you've just set a record for a Michael Jordan reference this early in the podcast. That's very sweet.
Yeah. What you want to do is you want to get your daughter a consultation with Jen Hawk. That's what you want to do. So
only if she wants one, yeah. I will add. Yeah. You know, consultations, often we like to book things for people, mm-hmm. Thinking that, you know, we can sort of force them into clarity because you hear it on the podcast and it sure sounds great. But if this has to come from her, she really has to feel like she's stuck and she wants to change.
Yeah, I would. So I would tell you how you do this, which is that if Jen is correct and it sure feels like it. It's got, this isn't somebody who, I mean, we could be dealing with something else. We could be dealing with an active anorexia that still hasn't really gone away. And at which point, you know, you need to talk to us. But it's also possible that there's a greater degree of anxious neuroticism in here than we know, and obviously that the ego trap isn't helping, but we could just be looking at, you know, an OCD-ish level meltdown and i.e. Howard Hughes. So we're not sure what it is, but it certainly looks like a young person of extraordinary conscientiousness that got driven into the ultimate competitive ego trap type situation. And so I think that Jen has probably got this right. I think the odds are 80%+ that that's kind of what the story is. And so the see if you can get her a consultation with me or Jen. And the way you would do this would be you'd say, hey, listen, you know, listen to some interesting people about, you know, making the most of your life. And they probably don't have anything useful to say. It's probably a total waste of time. But you never can tell. They're kind of interesting, kind of entertaining. So you may want to just take a half an hour and see what happens. There's no great loss. That's how you sell it.
Yeah, okay? Exactly. Yeah, not oh, this is the greatest thing that since sliced bread and it's going to change your life, because that just sets it up for a lot of resistance and makes it impossible for us to succeed, basically.
Yeah, it walks her right into the ego trap. So
yep. more ego trap on top of ego trap.
Right. So yeah. we go exactly the opposite way. It's probably a total waste of time, but might be mildly entertaining, et cetera. That's how we do it. So can't possibly, isn't going to hurt anything. You know, how we do it, and see what happens. So give that a try, because that's the best path out that I know.
Yeah.
All right. Outstanding, Jen.
Yeah, no, thank you. Likewise. And I do think your observation that there's fundamental personality stuff going on here, you know, it's all interactive.
Sure.
So it's she's predisposed to this type of ego trap, given that sort of high conscientious, high neurotic personality that we can kind of just infer from this history that we're being given. So,
yep.
Yeah.
All right, Nathan. All right. Very good.
Next.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lau, Dr. Hawk. All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, I was wondering if the doctors had any insights or thoughts on autism or Asperger's syndrome, particularly in women. I am a 35-year-old woman who has struggled in life in very specific ways that others seem unable to relate to. However, upon reading information relating to autism or Asperger's in women, the information tends to read more like a horoscope, broad and vague enough to apply to a large number of people. I'm trying to figure out if my issues are related to being on the spectrum or if they are simply a result of the combination of my big five traits.
Well, I'd be
yes,
really...
it's your personality. Next.
I'm glad, because sometimes I'm getting to the point where I want to know what you're thinking before I say anything, because you'll then, if you say a bunch of stuff that I wouldn't have thought of, I'm like, yeah, that sounds reasonable. Yeah, I can bluff my way through. But this one I had down on my notes, no difference.
No, exactly. It's a false. It's not either or. It's not, you know, you're not diagnosed as being on the spectrum, or it's just part of your personality. Those are different ways of saying the same thing.
Yep.
So this is what, you know, Robert Plowman famously in his book Blueprint calls the abnormal is normal. So there is everything is actually on a spectrum. We're not kind of conditioned to think of most things that we diagnose that way, but everything is that way, from heart disease to maybe with the exception of pregnancy, right? You're either pregnant or you're not, I suppose. The idea being that, you know, diagnosing you and saying, oh, yes, you have this disorder is really just a gift to the pharmaceutical industry and, you know, slots you in as a patient for life in the medical industrial complex. And really, these are just ways of describing that people are on different points of the bell curve with personality on the big five and all the other little personality quirks that go along with it.
Big five and the little 50.
And the little 50.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, if you were to read... that's what we call circuits. You know, you've got like a little circuit for, you got a little hoarding circuit in there when we say things like that.
Yeah.
That's something that's not necessarily a big five personality characteristic, but it's still being genetically determined by your wiring, essentially.
Yep.
And it's not little 50 is just a, you know, it's just a term. We're just BSing. It's right. not, it's not 50,
right?
But it's probably not a lot more than 50, and it's not less than 50.
Yeah. All good.
Yeah.
Good enough. What else we got, Nathan?
Wonderful. All right. That was a quick answer. I love it.
We're doing rapid fire. We're doing disagreeable rapid fire today.
Got it. That's it.
Jen wants to get back to the garden.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like the daylight is dwindling, people.
All right.
All right. Dear doctors, the unconscious evolutionary viewpoint is that friendships are valuable and must be pursued. In the past, I found myself bending over backwards with the metaphoric begging bowl looking for friendships. I'd attend parties, have inane conversations, listen to nonsensical personal problems, feel obligated to share some days of vacations or weekends, dine at expensive and unhealthy restaurants, etc. I'm now deeply uncomfortable with the realization that I find friendships draining, and the personal and psychological cost of friendships are absolutely not worth the payback. In addition, I absolutely adore my own company. I have a great relationship with my husband and children. We don't have personal or financial problems. We're healthy. I have enough casual interactions in a day. And if problems should ensue, I'm not sure I'd go to friends for help. I, in all likelihood, I'd rely on my finances to get paid help or medical assistance. If I was emotional or psychological help, I'd listen to trusted sources such as yourselves. I have no friends at all in the U.S. I've been here for 3 years and I could not be happier. In fact, I feel unburdened. My concern is that there is pressure to make and maintain social connections. For example, Dr. Dean Ornish believes social connections are one key to reversing disease. My concern is that this societal or evolutionary, perhaps, pressure could cause unnecessary anxiety for some people who become anxious trying to make or keep connections when they could be just as happy or even better off without the contrived social obligations and problems.
There's so many different ways we could answer this or look at it. I've got things swirling around in my head that I probably shouldn't dive into because we're starting to get into the mechanics
how the mind works. Here.
Yeah.
We can't have that.
No. So I would say first, you know, Dean Ornish doesn't know anything about any of this. So he's wrong. And the I would say sort of the top level feedback is that you've got 100,000 hours to spend in this life, more or less, waking hours. If you're Jen, maybe it's 200,000. If it's me, it's maybe 50,000. But whatever it is, it's finite. And for God's sakes, I mean, this person did a beautiful, disagreeably tinged tirade on all the time that they wasted, which yeah. is kind of an interesting little soliloquy.
There's definite disagreeable, there's a disagreeable filter on this question.
Yes, there's a significant
kind of coming across.
It's almost, yes. I mean, this is a woman, but it could be Alan. You know what I mean? Just mm-hmm. sort of whining about the 9 hours that he's wasted in the past 40 years, you know, dealing with other people that he didn't want to be there for.
they're not worth it.
There aren't 10 hours that he's wasted. Trust me. The issue is that we want to not be intimidated by false information, which is actually the thief of time. So if you have been mildly influenced, i.e. intimidated by a Dean Ornish or any other similar argument that there are, quote, needs that you should be addressing in order for your overall integrated health, and that friendship is one of those things, that's ludicrous. You have a circuit in you that tells you when you're deficient. It's called loneliness. That's all. Got a loneliness circuit. Okay. This is actually very much akin to the notion of, oh, well, you should drink, you know, 8 glasses of water a day. It's like, well, who the hell said? Okay. So you know, I just ran into somebody, an intelligent, educated human the other day, you know, dutifully explaining to me that they, you know, that they're keeping themselves hydrated. It's like, why? Like, where, who bought that argument? There's no support for it anywhere. And if you had the need to be hydrated, you've got a circuit in your hypothalamus. It's the thirst center that will actually tell you very clearly when it is that you are, when your fluid levels have dropped and the concentration of your blood has gotten a little bit too much for how much water is in there. So relax, everybody. You don't need to be chasing down anything that anybody says you need. All you have to do is be paying attention to your own instincts. That's it. So particularly in this arena. Yeah, so we don't need other people any more than your nervous system tells you that you need them. And you have a very well-engineered circuit called loneliness to tell you when you are effectively friendship deficient. So, you know, honor that. And otherwise, the ludicrous notion that your social relationships, that having a bunch of them, you know, it's actually a good question just because anybody's asking it and anybody's ever commenting on this. It takes me back, you know, 30 years to working in a state mental hospital where the big goal of the staff, you know, of the psychological staff was to see to it that the patients were interacting because that was good for them. It's as if social interaction was like a necessary vitamin, for God's sakes.
For a bunch of sociopaths.
Yeah. I mean, it's utterly ludicrous. So that's how I would look at this. So I'm in agreement with the undertone of the disagreeable human asking the question. And all I would say is, you know, what took you so long? Because,
yeah,
you know, I figured this out by easily the sixth grade.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally. I mean, the thing here is that you've got the mechanism called loneliness, which tells you when you're friendship deficient. But also, you're describing the only reason you need friends is for an insurance policy when shit hits the fan. That's why we're driven to make friendships. And you've got that coalition.
Yes,
you feel
right.
Very secure in your relationship, in your family, in your finances. So you essentially have an insurance. You have a blue ribbon insurance policy. Yeah. So you've got, you know, a little bit of disagreeableness in your nervous system, which is going to raise the standard of who qualifies for coalition.
Yeah.
And you have enough experience having these inane conversations and wasting your time at these things that you essentially, it's just, there's no cost benefit there anymore. It's like, well, why the hell pay a premium for an insurance policy I don't need? I've got one. I've got a perfectly good one that's going to pay out anytime I need it. So you're not interested in wasting additional time and energy. And you've got this social programming that we need social interaction and we need friendships, and it's this fundamental part of feeling connected and whole and healthy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the same as all of the studies saying that you need to supplement with this or that, and you know, you're going to improve your likelihood of being able to fight off COVID or anything else. Well, yes, that's true if you're deficient in those things.
Right.
So if you're deficient in zinc or you're deficient in vitamin D, supplementing will make a huge difference for you in your immune defense against COVID or anything else. But if you're not deficient, it's just, you're just going to pee it out, right? It's just like, it's not going to do you any good and can actually be harmful at some point, or some things can. So same principle applies here, that you're not deficient. You don't need it. You feel completely secure in your coalition and your insurance policy. And all of those people making those recommendations are coming from the perspective of deficiency, which doesn't apply to you. So, and they're, you know, kind of just making it up a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah.
It just sounds good.
You know, Dean Ornish, he put that, well, his original program that he published in The Lancet under was called Open Your Heart. Okay.
Right.
And so, and that was a big part of the deal, was this group where they talked about, this is just psychodynamic horse manure. And so
I think it's to be more charitable.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's Dean. Dean's a really sweet, open-hearted guy. You know, he's really like he's got a lot of egocentric bias here. So if you follow Dean on Instagram, you'll see him, you know, write these 5-paragraph long things about how much he loves his wife and what a great relationship they have every anniversary or birthday. And he's just, this is his personality. So he sees this everywhere as a fundamental piece of human happiness because it is for him.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, you've got to account for egocentric bias coming through research design, which it did in his case.
Right.
And then when it comes through research design, it comes through in the results or the purported results. And then, you know, you write a few books and you kind of become associated with that, and then it just becomes part of your whole the message that you give people.
So right, and then
I don't think it's harmful, but
then Esselstyn made sure that he came behind that and cleaned it up, got better results, and made sure it wasn't in his program
with no love and connection.
Okay, just eat the damn food properly. And got
go
better.
Sit in a room and eat a potato.
That's it.
And mean people
and guess what?
Reverse heart disease. So.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So yeah, everybody, your system in terms of your health is extraordinarily mechanical, and so your emotional life. We wandered sideways into a major misunderstanding, and that is that very negative emotions do not cause physical damage. The entire purpose of very negative emotions is to tell you that you are going to experience very significant losses that need to be encoded into memory so that the situational aspects of those losses are remembered, so in order to improve your future functioning and decision-making. This is not damaging, for God's sakes. And even if it's extremely unpleasant, it is not damaging. The point is to calibrate for you and to encode it in your memory structure so that you have a reduced likelihood of experiencing these losses in the future because you're likely to make better decisions. So, but somehow in the la-la land of modern, you know, woo-woo thinking, The notion is that psychologically traumatic things and unpleasant things somehow are damaging to you physically. It's utterly ludicrous. So and Dean Ornish has bought into that and many other people. And it's behind that willful ignorance, which I would have to say that it's willful ignorance at this point. So Dean Ornish knows enough to know that it's BS. And so but why would you, besides all the reasons Jen talked about, you know, stand behind that? Well, it feels and sounds virtuous. It feels and sounds, caring and concerning, agreeable, pleasant. It also, though, I would argue from my very disagreeable, you know, mechanical engineering brain is basically saying, listen, if you believe that that's even 1% true, then you are giving everybody a free pass who basically eats a bunch of nachos but has a bunch of friends over and says, you know what? The friendship and the warmth and the love that I have with my buddies, that experience was more than any damage the nachos did. And that is 100% bullshit. It didn't do you physically any good at all. And that every nacho got calculated in dinging your car door, you know, of your arteries, just as whether or not you were sitting there eating those nachos lonely. So the notion that, you know, the first thing I see when people start talking this kind of language is they are looking to circumvent the laws of nature. That they're trying to say, oh, stress, that's the big thing. No, it's not stress. It's the shit you're eating and the shit you're smoking. That's what the problem is. Okay? It's not your stress. So that's why my hackles go up at anything that even is remotely tangentially related to that. So, you know, Jen's a nicer person, so she's going to give Dean Ornish a pass. You know, I don't. I think that's perpetrating errors. To, you know, a small error will do a small amount of damage. A big error will do a big amount of damage. And so by people in trouble taking their eye off the ball and thinking that, well, my emotional life's good and that's where I'm getting nurture and that's opening my heart. No, it's not opening your frickin' heart. It's not doing a damn thing.
I think even it's not defending Ornish Day, no. But I think it would be mischaracterizing his work and his, you know, the argument for people to interpret it that way. So yes. I don't think he would stand behind that interpretation. He, you know, if he were pushed, he would say, well, no, you still need to eat the food and get the exercise and do the program.
Sure.
But people will interpret. I mean, the number of times that when I was at True North, there would be a talk that had this kind of perspective, you know, people would come through and give this kind of talk. And I would see people, you know, after listening to you and I and Alan, kind of the other docket, they would hear something a little more sympathetic and a little more like, it's emotional trauma and love and connection, et cetera, whatever perspective it was coming from. And a lot of people had that perspective, and you could see the relief that people would have. And, and I would over and over again, see people go up to the speaker, whoever it was, and say, oh, I've been waiting to hear this. I've been waiting to hear something like this. I've just been hearing all of this really harsh mechanistic stuff. And you know, so here you it's a balm to be told it's not my fault.
Right.
And so it is. I mean that's why it perpetuates. That's why, you know, it's a soft message. It does confer some virtue on the speaker, and a lot of people want to hear it and you know, buy it. And so I don't think it's part of Dean specifically, you know, he is not out there saying just have some connections and love and you'll be your heart disease will go away. But I do think he benefits, just like many do, from people kind of making that inference and running with it.
That was always disgusting to me at True North. Whenever I found anything that was going on, I just felt like, what the hell? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, the rats have eaten their way under the fence. And it's disgusting. So, but anyway, Dean Ornish is not disgusting. I think you've characterized probably his personality and his inclusion in that, you know, very well. I think that's right on target. He hasn't wavered from his message about the central importance of the diet and exercise and et cetera. So all good there. But when we start to, but like in this questioner, you know, is actually names him. I mean, Dean isn't even come close to the biggest perpetrator. But the
not nearly.
Not even. No. He's nowhere near it. Okay. But the point is
not
is
even
that
within the plant based world.
Right. But that little mistake. You know, I heard Joel Fuhrman or somebody told me that Joel Fuhrman was going off big on this. That, you know, that you're the psychological. I don't know if this is true. All I know is that something that somebody sent me. Okay, so could be absolutely not what Joel said, but it was about the same notion of psychodynamic, you know, processes of your emotional life are more important than your food. So that could have been a total misquote and mischaracterization of a recent Joel's comment. But if it isn't a mischaracterization, then Joel has jumped right off the high dive right into this same sewer. You know, same thing. So anyway, that's what gets my little hackles up.
I've watched videos from Dr. McDougall. I've listened, read journal articles about the mechanism behind heart disease, how it's created, how it gets reversed, all the thinking behind that.
Yeah.
I have yet to read anything that even remotely comes close to explain the neurological pathways or the what happens when there's psychological trauma. There doesn't seem to be a sequela there, and that's I will wait until that happens. But the only mild connection is like cortisol.
The brain.
Yeah, the only thing I've seen is like, oh, it increases cortisol, but it's like that's just really weak in my mind. So
yeah, of course.
Wait for the mechanism.
Yeah. Of course, it changes cortisol. In other words, the organism is under stress, so the cortisol is up. So what? That's like saying, oh, well, you just ran up the stairs and your heart and your blood pressure's up. Well, no joke, it's up. It's like saying, oh, I just ate an apple. My blood sugar rose. Well, it was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
So, there are compensatory mechanisms to the stresses of life. That doesn't mean, for God's sake, it damages the organism. Otherwise, you'd just be, you know, sitting under a blanket and trying not to move while we fed you soup through a straw. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to something else.
Doug and I we're just full of beans this week.
Yeah, just as a testimonial, I watch these every once in a while. It's fun to watch these videos on the social media of these dogs that get rescued, and they're like miserable, depressed, scared out of their minds. Yeah. And then a few weeks later, when they've been fed, they've been clothed, they've been loved, all of a sudden now it's like they forgot everything. They're not traumatized.
So life's great. Yeah. As long as the environment is feeding you evidence that you're in good circumstances, why wouldn't the organism be in a good emotional state? Okay, of course. All right. What else we got? Right. Got anything else?
Yeah, I
Nathan?
Think. Let's see. How about do you want to do the one about the jealous friends, and then, or you want to go to the 10-paid dates men aren't paying anymore?
Oh, go to that.
Okay,
one.
Let's do that.
I want to hear Jen. Jen, dump on that. Go ahead.
All right. Dear Dr. Hawk, well, actually, dear doctors, I'm trying to follow your 10-paid date strategy, but men just don't pay anymore. Or this is what I'm finding. Isn't this a slightly archaic expectation, or do I need to lower my standards? I'm 40 and would very much like to find the right man and have a kid while I still can. I'm athletic, a solid 9 physically, and of high intelligence, relatively successful, and highly agreeable. I've been on dating apps for over a year and have been on countless dates. The only man who paid for our date knew about the 10-paid date strategy and was honest enough to tell me he's only interested in casual mating.
Oh, shout out to that guy. Hey, Jimmy. Nice to... Glad you're listening.
Boy, that's a weird sounding letter, but go have at it, Jen.
Yeah, I mean, my first reaction to this is that this is absolutely true. I think in my personal experience and of all of my friends and repeatedly with clients, I mean, I think the expectations of men paying for dates has just changed profoundly. And so women will find themselves in the situation where if they're actually trying to follow 10 paid dates to the letter, it causes a type of conflict in the relationship that's not very productive. The man starts to feel like she's really taking advantage of him. It sets up this whole problematic cycle that is actually going to short circuit what 10 paid dates is trying to do. So all that 10 paid dates is trying to do is to try to smoke him out of the point where he thinks he's made enough investment to get in your pants, basically. You just need to, what I've secretly been telling clients for the last couple of years when they come to me with this thing without telling Doug that I'm quietly undermining 10 paid dates.
Is now the truth is coming out.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Is that 10 paid dates is just it's a guideline that there's no, you don't actually need to go on 10 paid dates where he pays and it's a real date and, you know, he's taking you to dinner and a movie or whatever. It's a relative proposition where if he's expecting sex on date number 2, you wait until you start seeing some signs of irritation, or you would start expecting some signs of irritation because you haven't been putting out on subsequent dates. Basically, that's the whole exercise of what's going on here. So if it's date number 2 comes and goes and he starts getting shitty about it, well, that's your answer. You don't need to go to 10 paid dates. You've discovered that you've got somebody who's only interested in casual mating, and he's already feels like he's invested enough time and energy and money, whether he's paying for the dates or not. We would hope that he's going to pay for some of them, but I don't think you need to make that into a big thing if it's going to kind of undermine your ability to get this data. Watching.
Go ahead. We lost some audio somewhere. Yeah. Go ahead.
You're still there? Oh, yeah. Well, I've been recording. Okay, so keep going. Yeah, just the phone connection broke up a little bit. Yeah. So all the female's job with 10 paid dates is to just push the envelope of his expectations to a point where he starts to leak his real feelings about the situation. Mm-hmm. And so he will, you know, if he's actually pursuing casual mating strategy, he's going to get irritated long before the 10th date. And you're going to be able to see it. If he's really in for a pair bond, it's going to be really obvious by date 3 or 4 that he's just happy to sit there there and he's in no hurry and he's not getting pushy and he's not making you uncomfortable, et cetera. So whether he's paying or not, you know, I think that's an important element. It's not the only element. And I totally agree with this questioner that men under 50, in my experience, are just not going to pay for dates. what happens is they sort of make an effort, or usually they'll maybe pay for the first one if it's a small date. And after that, it's an expectation that you're splitting the bill all the way. They might kind of pull out their wallet and then you pull out your wallet and there's a little bit of a, oh no, no. Oh, okay. You go ahead. And so that's a frustration of, women sort of in their 40s and younger, I believe, in this market. That's my experience.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. I'd almost want more data, you know what I mean, from this before I necessarily believe you. And I think one of these problems is that I'm, of course, sitting on my own egocentric bias, where you know, obviously I was born in the 1950s, for God's sakes. Barely. Okay. But the...
okay, boomer.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's... Now I completely agree in principle. In other words, 10 paid dates is a metaphor. It's right. It's not a rule. So that's the critical thing that Jen's trying to explain. I will also, though, I want to underscore something that I've heard, you know, 30 times in the last, you know, 10 years, ever since I came up with the concept of 10 paid dates, which has been around for me for a long time in therapy sessions. And that I probably had 30 men tell me that when they met somebody that they were extremely interested in, they had a decided shift in strategy that was palpable. They knew that what they felt like doing was effectively providing, and they weren't in any hurry, okay? Now, that is interesting. And that the first I'm not sure where I first understood this logic. It was either, might have been out of David Buss, but I have a feeling it was in The Moral Animal. And I think it was. And it was Robert Wright, you know, having synthesized an awful lot of evidence, that was thinking through that a guy that's in a pair bond situation, in other words, finds himself in a pair bond situation, is basically in no hurry to copulate because he wants to be staring at that girl's stomach for the next 2 months and seeing if there's any incipient children coming. That this is that you're looking at an instinctual adaptation inside the system, and so which is going to be decidedly different than if he is effectively not that impressed with the female and is just going to look to be taking his turn. So that is very possible that is a design feature of male psychology. And I don't know that that's true, but I know that it rings certainly to a certain degree true in my own mind. And it has rung true in a couple dozen males that have heard this and said, yeah, that... I hadn't had that feeling really before or rarely, and now I just met Miss X, and that is exactly what I'm experiencing. So I have had many people report instinctual discoveries like that. I had a man who is a very, very tough guy and was married and never really wanted to have kids, and it wasn't a big deal to him, but it was a big deal to his wife. And once he had his daughter, then he had a second one shortly thereafter. He told me that there was some little threat to those kids from some quarter, whatever it was, and he was ready to lay waste to whoever it was that was involved. And he was inherently a tough guy, but under a tremendous amount of control, a huge IQ. And he said, he looked at me and he said, I had no idea that that was in there. None. In other words, he didn't know that it was no problem for him to feel murderous at anybody that would attack his children. And he was like, whoa, you know, 4 years earlier, he was debating and not even wanting to have them. He's like, oh, these are mine and the most precious thing on earth. And anybody comes near them, they're done. Okay. And that kind of, you know, that makes sense of obviously deep instinctual programs. This pair bond strategy on the part of the male, also, it's possible that that's a design strategy. So anyway, this is a long meandering discussion, but Jen's point is one that I agree with, that 10 paid dates is metaphorical. It is certainly very extensive. I can tell you, though, I could actually tell you this, Jen, as cheap of a guy and as wild of a guy as Larry was, that went down with Larry.
Yeah, but Larry's old.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, so Dr. Hawk, you're saying it's a low testosterone.
But I mean, he was a child, though. He's coming of age in the 1970s. You know what I'm saying? So the truth
is... But he's
still
very old-fashioned. I mean, Larry's got an old-fashioned, you know, vibe. Yes, there's the wildness, but he's opening doors.
That's true.
He's courting.
Yes.
He's courting the female.
Right.
And he's trying to prove himself. And
right.
He's got a little bit of that, like, you know, I'm a little knight in shining armor
right.
thing going on. And
right.
It's not there with the younger guys.
Yeah.
Occasionally it will be. And it's almost jarring when you find it because it's like, wow, you're a throwback. You've been listening to some evolutionary psychology podcasts. Like, where'd you come from? Well, really, it's much more about signaling, hey, man, I'm a feminist, you know, all equal rights, equal pay, equal sharing of the bill. You know,
oh my God.
Like that is inferred by most guys under 50 to give them more status in the dating market than paying for a date.
What a mistake. Yeah,
it's a huge mistake, and it's and it pisses off every woman I've ever talked to. Every woman I've ever talked to is like, men never pay for dates anymore, and they don't.
Wow,
Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle,
all the guys can listen.
Do you think if these ladies were, say, to date down a little bit, then they would start to encounter these men, or could they just be?
I know.
Could they just be trying to get a guy that's they actually think they're nines, but they may not actually be, and so they're just encountering a casual mater?
Well, you know, that's a good question, Nathan, but Jen's pointing out something, and this is actually, you talk about grounds for a legitimate PhD in social psychology. This is a doctoral dissertation, okay?
Yeah.
Because this is super interesting, including the question that you're asking, Nathan. In other words, I'm old school, so that basically I read somewhere, God knows, it was probably in, you know, The Sensuous Man or God, Zavira Hollander essay somewhere. I don't know where it is that I read it. But the notion was the man is inviting the woman. And if you're inviting, she's your guest and therefore you should be paying. That should be the... That's the underlying contract inside that situation, for goodness sakes. You don't invite somebody over to dinner and then say, well, what'd you bring? Okay. And so that has, you know, and certainly my father, my parents, I mean, that's exactly how that I would have gone about everything. God knows, I can't remember what this meandering answer is. Oh, but the point is that you're asking an interesting issue, and that is that, and it would, if I was a female, it would be very difficult for me to not be making an inference as to how valuable he found me by observing his willingness and eagerness to pay. I can't think that has to be in his calculus. Now, how much is in his calculus, and a bunch of other things are in that calculus. It gets to be complicated, and this where it gets to be an interesting sociological question. How old is he? How old are you? You know, what the hell's going on inside that head? But it would almost be impossible for me to think that some guy strikes gold, you know what I mean, and managed to go up 20 or 25 percentile from his attractiveness level. How can that guy not be thinking, let me pay the way? Now, actually, my, again, generation, we're going to go back to the late 90s when my ex-wife started dating again, and she would have been mid-30s. And so that was 20-ish years ago. And she and the guy that married her made it exceedingly clear immediately that, number one, he was in no rush, and number two, he was paying for everything. And it was a whirlwind courtship where it was basically he wanted to do it, and he was showing off. And that was, I didn't know everything I knew at the time, but it sounded right to me at the time. And that was it. That was absolutely how that went down. So, you know, Jen's basically saying, Doug's an old guy, you know what I mean? He doesn't know anything.
Yeah, but I have friends that are my age, and they talk exactly like Dr. Lyle's saying, is that for some girls, they're willing to shell it out, and for some girls, they're not. Like, it's unfortunately, yeah. I mean, that's got a crass it. Way of well, putting
I,
it. But
no, I yeah. think... I think we've got, I think all of us, these are all little swirling pieces of a sociological cauldron. And I think that in any one situation, you can't know why the decisions are going down the way they're going down. The guy could be pouring money on the hot girl just because he's interested in casual mating. And he's just trying to, you know, that's his ticket to get to the goal. So I don't think, I think that what we're talking about here is that there's a lot of little elements, there are iron filings all over this thing. And that at the end, we come down to what Jen's distillation is, which is that, that 10 paid dates it's a general process of where it is that you are looking to withhold long enough to see how far it is, when does he start to show irritation? Right. And that's really what it's point. About. What's that?
That's all that this is about. That's all yes. you're really doing.
Exactly.
I think a big piece of the sort of sociological disparities here is, my personal experience and that of my closest friends and a lot of my clients is, markets that are urban centers with sort of, leftish values.
Right.
So I think you're probably going to see something very different if you were to go try to, date in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Right.
Than yes. Boston.
A lot of my friends are conservative.
And so... So I think there are big values differentials here in how people are seeking to display and how they're seeking to show off. And in sort of high achieving
yes.
leftist cities, it is you get more status. The perception is that there's greater status with the females to sort of display your you're equal to me, and that goes for you make more money than I do, and I'll let you get the bill this time. So that's
you know what, Jen, that's fantastic. That's really, really insightful. That's
driving
great.
A lot of the
I gotta tell you, when I started dating many years ago, and I don't know how this situation came up, because God knows I wouldn't have been bitching about the bill, but somehow Alan and I had some discussion about this. And his wife's right there. And Alan says, well, here's how you do it, Doug. You just tell them all, listen, they pay the first date. And if there's any dates after that, you'll pay all the rest forever.
Oh, jeez. Of course, Alan would come to that perfect algorithm. Because that's actually perfect.
Yeah. There you go. Oh, my God. So there you have it.
Oh, maximum efficiency.
That's it.
And she says, okay, well, the first date is, we'll go have tea.
Tea,
we'll
right.
go sit at a bar and have tea, and we'll share tea.
Yeah. But I mean, hilariously, I think that's exactly, Alan would be fine with that. Like, hey, fine.
Yeah, no.
As long as you qualify. Alan would qualify somebody on date one.
Yeah.
Like he'd cross-examine them into the ground. Yeah, that's how that works.
Yep. All well, right. And women should. Yeah, your first date should be a coffee date or a tea date. It should mm-hmm. not be dinner. It should not be some big, involved, expensive thing. It's less of a date, especially if this is an online type thing. It's different, of course, if you're already in a repeat exposure process with someone you know from work or something. But if this is an online date and you're going to meet for the first time, you want that to be a very low commitment screening date. It is not a real date. And so it's not a big deal if he doesn't pay, A, that tells you something, and B, you're only out a couple of bucks if you wind up paying for the whole thing, or your half in either case. But you shouldn't consider a first date a date. It's a screening. It's an initial screening to see if they're worthy of a first date.
All reasonable.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's great, Nathan.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lau, Dr. Hawk.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. So just to remind all the listeners to go to esteemdynamics.com and check out the Living Wisdom Libraries for more of this kind of discussion.
More of our disagreeableness. Yeah,
there you go. That's good. All right. Well, Jen, you got any daylight left?
I got some daylight left. I've got some berry bushes that need to be planted. So I'm going to go out there and get busy.
All right. Well, be careful. Look out for the poison ivy. Watch out.
Yeah, that's no joke. Yeah. Seriously, that and the poison hemlock and the giant hogweed.
Yeah.
It's dangerous out there.
There you go.
All right.
Okay, Nathan, thank you.
Thank you guys so much.
All right, guys, have a good night.
Thanks for listening.
Right. Bye.
If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.